Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to More Outdoors. This is Chester Moore, and do we have a fascinating program tonight. We're going to be talking about snake bites and snake venom with Dr. Spencer Green. He's a board-certified medical toxicologist, and he is the man in the, the Houston area for snake bites and venom, published lots of articles, done lots of lectures, founded some great response to snake bite institutions and things like that. We have a wild ride with Dr. Spencer Green. All right, so, you know, you say shark in the water and people freak out. You know, you say snake anywhere, you get the same response. You know, you get a few people like me like, oh, cool, where's the snake? And then you get other people like, oh, my God. You know, that name, of course, any kind of snake thing puts fear into many people in the public. And, you know, there is a deserved little bit of that. There are venomous snakes out there that can cause harm to people. But there are also a lot of myths, and these are the things we want to talk about in the program. But we mainly want to talk about the pit vipers here in America, which are our cottonmouths, copperheads, and rattlesnakes, and the venom that they have. And that is a hemotoxic venom. Can you explain what that means?
So let's talk about all the venom components. So, you know, when it comes to pit vipers, their venom is described as a soup of antigens because there are so many different components that do many different things. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll hear a lot of people refer to it as hemotoxic, mm-hmm. but that's not painting a complete picture. That's just part of it. Mm-hmm. And tissue injury is what we see in over 95% of our pit viper envenomations. Mm-hmm. It's also the only thing we see in about 3/4 of our envenomations. So much of what I recommend, much of what the literature recommends, is geared toward minimizing tissue injury. Mm-hmm. Hemotoxicity is when you cause hematologic lab abnormalities, such as low platelets or low fibrinogen or elevated prothrombin time, mm-hmm. which may or may not be associated with bleeding. But what people often call hemotoxic is actually cytotoxic.
Go ahead.
We do see hematologic toxicity sometimes, but fortunately, medically significant bleeding is really, really rare. Mm-hmm. Finally, the other type of manifestations we see following a pit viper envenomation are systemic toxicity, which can range from multiple episodes of vomiting or diarrhea to difficulty breathing, all the way to cardiovascular collapse. And we see that with a severe envenomation. Mm-hmm. A lot of these cases, unfortunately, they're not common. A lot of these cases are incorrectly labeled as anaphylaxis, and it's frustrating because the management is different for anaphylaxis than from a severe envenomation. So it's important to distinguish them.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I mean, for the most part, if you look at any main literature, handout stuff you get out there educationally, you see hemotoxic, you see neurotoxic. You know, that's the two things you certainly see. And of course, this is why I have a doctor on the air here answering these questions. So I want to talk about, number one, before we go any further, if no one else listens to anything else in this program, what someone should do if they are bitten by a pit viper. What's the first step you should take?
A step back from the snake.
Yeah, there you go.
So you don't want to get bitten again. You don't want any harm to come to yourself or any rescuers. And I don't want any harm to come to the snake. What should you do? It's very simple. Most of the things that were recommended previously have proven to be useless at best, mm-hmm. and dangerous at worst.
Okay.
What you definitely do not have to do, and it makes me crazy when you have physicians telling people this, what we do not have to do is bring the snake into the hospital. You know, obviously a live snake poses a threat to a bunch of people, yeah. and that snake's life is at risk as well. Mm-hmm. But even a dead snake can still envenomate. You know, there was mm-hmm. a guy in Texas 2 years ago who almost died after being bitten by a decapitated rattlesnake. And that story got a lot of attention. Surprisingly, what didn't get a lot of attention was the gentleman who actually died from a decapitated prairie rattlesnake in South Dakota a few years before that. So we don't want to bring in the dead snake, and we don't want to bring in the live snake. If you can quickly and safely take a picture of the snake, that's wonderful, but it's not essential. Ultimately, making the diagnosis of a pit viper inflammation is clinical. Anyone who knows anything about snake bites can easily recognize the clinical features of a pit viper bite. Mm-hmm. The problem is, many people don't. So what should you do? If you can quickly and safely take a picture, great. Otherwise, get away from the snake, get somewhere safe. You want to calm down. You need to understand that death is really, really uncommon following pit viper bites in the United States. There's an average of 3.4 deaths per year in the United States, and oftentimes it's people who don't seek any medical attention. So just going to the hospital makes it almost definitely that you're going to survive. I can't promise it, but, you know, way, way, way more often than not. Mm-hmm. So be calm. Realize that what we worry about primarily is tissue injury and local disability, not death. So calm down, call 911 or call someone to take you to the hospital. You know, whether you go by ambulance or by car kind of depends on how far you live from the hospital and what kind of symptoms you're having. For a typical copperhead bite associated with tissue injury but not associated with systemic toxicity more often than not, mm-hmm. if you're only a few minutes away by car, have someone drive you. It's a whole lot faster than calling 911. On the other hand, if you're a ways away from the hospital and if you're having any symptoms like trouble breathing or lightheadedness or chest pain, definitely call 911. Mm-hmm. So arrange to get yourself to the hospital. Other than that, remove anything constrictive, whether it's jewelry or clothing. You want nothing tight against the affected limb.
Well, that goes completely against everything I saw in Western movies. You got to take your bandana off and restrict the venom, right? You got to make a, you know, you always see that. And I actually still see that popping up every once in a while as advice.
And it's so frustrating because it's one of the worst things you can do. Mm-hmm. What are we worried about with pit viper bites? Primarily tissue injury. Anything that restricts the flow of the lymph is going to increase the local damage. We don't want to use a tourniquet. Tourniquets are great for life-threatening bleeding, as in trauma, but this is something completely different. Cutting off the arterial blood supply to a limb that's already been envenomated is just adding insult to injury.
Wow.
We don't want to do that. We don't even want to do pressure immobilization. First of all, you're not going to do it right. There was a great study out of California showing that nobody can do this correctly. But even if you could, all you're doing is preventing the systemic absorption of a venom that's likely to cause local injury. And you're concentrating the venom locally. Mm-hmm. You're increasing the local pressures, and you're going to damage the lymphatic vessels. So we don't want to do anything tight. In fact, you want to elevate the affected limb to get all the fluid out of the affected limb. And this also goes contrary to what was taught previously and what's unfortunately still being taught by people who should know better. Mm-hmm. We know, those of us who treat snake bites have known for years, that elevating the affected limb improves outcomes. We now have data proving it, but some people still don't get it. What I find is that the second I elevate the limb, it helps with the pain and the swelling. We know that people get better faster. So remove anything tight, elevate the affected limb, and don't do anything stupid. And by that I mean don't use, you know, cutting and sucking. Don't use electricity to neutralize the venom.
This I was going to ask about the old stun gun thing, which always seemed kind of shady to me.
Stun guns, you know, the theory behind them is that you can denature the venom. Yeah. But you know what else it does? It can denature the human, the victim.
Sure.
It doesn't help. It causes a local injury and occasionally kills people. And I always joke, you know, it's kind of cool in a Tarantino sort of way to hook your friends up to a car battery or whatever, but it's not going to do anything good for the bite whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So don't do that. And do not use those extraction devices, the venom extraction devices. Mm-hmm. They're still sold everywhere, and it's horrifying. You know, there are about 11 of us who were involved with a public awareness campaign last year to get these off the market. They don't actually remove venom. What they do accomplish is removing interstitial fluid and creating a negative pressure injury that exacerbates the injury. Hmm. They make things worse, and that's why my favorite editorial of all time was written by my good friend and colleague Sean Bush back in February 2004 in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. He looked at all the data. He correctly concluded that these extraction devices don't help. All they do is cause damage. So the title of the editorial is Venom Extraction Devices Don't Remove Venom. They Just Suck.
Ha! I like it. Great title.
Yeah. So don't do any of that stuff. Just get to the right hospital. And I want to emphasize that while I have the chance. In Texas and surrounding areas where there's a lot of bites, you'd think all hospitals know how to manage snake bites. That is sadly not true. Mm-hmm. I would argue that most hospitals manage snake bites very poorly, whether it's a lack of understanding or a lack of caring or a lack of resources or what. Most bites are not managed correctly. And as someone who's devoted his career to managing snake bites, it's disheartening to see how poorly so many lights go. You know, whether they get undertreated or incorrectly treated, you know, things like surgical intervention, which is really never necessary acutely for a snake bite. Mm-hmm. You want to go to the right hospital. You want to go to the place where you have a snake bite expert. And although most places don't have a snake bite expert, you can always find someone in a region who knows what he or she is doing. And, you know, fortunately in Houston, people know about me.
When we come back on More Outdoors, we'll talk more with Dr. Spencer Green.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back to More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. You can listen to this show podcast at klvi.com and via the iHeartRadio app. Go to klvi.com and click on the podcast link. You'll see years worth of archival material. Continuing our conversation with Dr. Spencer Green on venomous snake bites.
You know, whether they get undertreated or incorrectly treated, you know, things like surgical intervention, which is really never necessary acutely for a snake bite. Mm-hmm. You want to go to the right hospital. You want to go to the place where you have a snake bite expert. And although most places don't have a snake bite expert, you can always find someone in a region who knows what he or she is doing. And, you know, fortunately in Houston, people know about me. In other cities, they have other people, but you don't want to go to a place that doesn't have expertise because you may not get treated in a timely fashion. You may not get treated correctly. And the worst case scenario, you'll get treated incorrectly to the point where they're causing damage. You know, surgeons should not be touching snake bites acutely, and really almost never chronically, only if there's full thickness necrosis, which is exceptionally rare. Mm-hmm. But acutely, it's not a surgical condition. It is a medical condition best managed with medicine, and specifically antivenom. And that's the other thing. A lot of hospitals carry it. Many hospitals don't know when to pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. They just don't treat aggressively enough, even though we have great literature mm-hmm. showing that even mild bites get better faster when you treat them correctly with antivenom.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I kind of want to kind of park here a second, is on antivenom. There's just so much out there, you don't know what to believe. You hear things like there's this mega shortage of them. You hear things like, do you have to have a specific one for a copperhead, for a rattlesnake, for a cottonmouth? I mean, let's start with the kind of antivenom. So is there a vial out there that says Western Diamondback on it and one that says cottonmouth on it? Or
no.
Yeah, okay.
So there are two FDA-approved antivenoms for North American pit vipers. Mm-hmm. Crowfoot has been on the market in the United States since the end of 2000, and it's approved for North American pit vipers in adults and pediatric patients.
Mm-hmm.
Anavip has been on the market since 2018, and it got approved, and it was originally approved just for rattlesnakes. It is now also approved for copperheads and cottonmouths in adult and pediatric patients. So they both have the same indications. They seem to have different advantages and disadvantages. Here in copperhead country, I think Crowfab is a better product. I think it's a safer and more cost-effective product.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in rattlesnake country prefer Anavip because it seems to reduce the incidence of what we call hematologic recurrence, which is when your hematologic toxicity, which was present originally and then gets better, it comes back. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem we see in copperhead country. So Anavip is a solution to a problem we don't have. Conversely, Crowfab seems to do a whole lot better job managing the local tissue effects, which is what we worry about with copperheads and cottonmouths.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it in a much more cost-effective way. So I think Crowfab is a better product for our copperheads and cottonmouths here where I practice.
Ah, very interesting. I live right smack in the middle of both. So I got copperheads on one side of my deer lease in the high part, and I have to walk through a swamp loaded with cottonmouths on the other. And, those in Southeast Texas here are pretty much the two you're mainly going to run into. Of course, go a little bit west or even around Galveston Island and places like that, you encounter rattlesnakes and things, of course. Now, let's talk about the individual pit vipers that we have here. Let's talk about that copperhead for a second. It's probably the snake that bites the most people, at least in East Texas, for sure. They're very
absolutely, and in the country.
Yeah, in the country as well. Okay, I know mm-hmm. they're very common. You know, they're not afraid to be around suburban areas and stuff like that where people are. Let's talk about the bite of a copperhead. Maybe like the average scenario, if there's such a thing, and maybe what the worst scenario could be.
Okay, well, the worst scenario is easy. Death.
Yeah, okay.
Copperheads can cause death. In fact, there have been 6 deaths attributed to copperheads in the last 33 years. Wow. I noticed because I wrote the article detailing all the snake bite fatalities in the United States in the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I should say from 1989 to 2018, there's been 1 copperhead death since then. It makes me crazy when people minimize the significance of copperheads. You'll hear people say incorrectly, oh, no one can die from it. Bullshit. Yes, they can, and they have.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only species that's been proven to cause more deaths than the copperhead is the timber rattlesnake in the last 30-odd years.
A timber rattlesnake. Very interesting.
Yes. And there's reasons for that, including the large geographic distribution and the fact that timber rattlesnakes are used in the religious services by snake handlers who subsequently don't seek medical attention when they get bitten.
Mm-hmm.
But copperheads and eastern diamondbacks were tied for second.
Hmm.
That's not to say that the copperhead is the most dangerous snake. There's just a lot of copperhead bites.
Yeah, a lot of snakes.
They can certainly cause fatalities. And I'm sure there's someone out there listening thinking, oh, well, that's because of allergic reaction. No, it isn't. It's because of a severe envenomation.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every copperhead death we've had in the last 33 years, we know for a fact, was not due to anaphylaxis, but rather a severe systemic envenomation.
Hmm.
So that's the worst case scenario. Best case scenario, of course, is a dry bite, meaning no venom's delivered. But here's the thing. Dry bites are really uncommon. Fewer than 10% of the people who come to the emergency department with a copperhead bite have a dry bite.
Hmm.
They have some evidence of envenomation. It may be minimal, may be mild, could be moderate, could be severe.
Mm-hmm.
But most people have signs of an envenomation. If you have swelling, if you have bruising, regardless of what your labs show, you have an envenomation. A dry bite means no venom was delivered, and the only symptoms you're going to have is going to feel like a thumbtack. That's it, like a little pinprick.
Yep.
If you have any swelling and bruising, it's not a dry bite. And yet, so often, you'll hear physicians say, oh, it's a dry bite because the labs are fine. I don't care if his arm is swollen up the size of a car. You know, that's not a dry bite. On average, we'll see mild to moderate, you know, effects. So we'll see significant local swelling and tenderness. We may see some lab abnormalities, but more often than not, we don't see any lab abnormalities. And we may see some mild systemic, you know, symptoms such as nausea. Less commonly will we see things like recurrent episodes of vomiting, recurrent episodes of diarrhea, difficulty breathing, or low blood pressure. They can all happen, but usually it's the local injury that we see.
No.
And it can be impressive.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen copperhead bites causing, you know, significant swelling of the whole limb. We also get a lot of local, you know, effects such as these hemorrhagic blebs, these huge blood blisters. And they can be really, really scary looking, but fortunately, it's usually superficial. It's a collection of blood under the top layer of skin,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately they heal fine as long as you don't think stupid. All too often I see people say, oh, you have to get that cut out. You have to get that finger amputated. No, you don't. You manage it conservatively, and they do just fine.
Hmm. The reason I ask about particularly starting with the copperhead, because you hear a lot of different stuff. I mean, I know a guy who got bit, said he didn't go to the hospital, just mild swelling. And, you know, and I've heard people on social media say a lot of stuff like this. And I'm like, dude, if it's a snake bite and you get venom in you, you need to go to the hospital and get checked out no matter what you get bit by. That's just my common sense is like, you know, you don't know what could happen down the line. And the copperhead seems to have a lot of people out there just kind of saying, ah, no big deal. But I personally have interviewed a couple of people that had really bad copperhead bites over throughout my years as a wildlife journalist. And, it wasn't just a, you know, it wasn't just stay at home, put some ice on it kind of thing. It was a, hey, we had to spend some time in the hospital because of, it was a pretty bad envenomation.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. Many people will recover, but 2 things to know. 1, getting treated with anti-venom will accelerate recovery. That was the main takeaway point from our randomized clinical trial
mm-hmm.
looking at CROFAP for copperhead bites. The people who got treated with antivenom got better in a clinically and statistically significant way compared to those who went untreated.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing to remember is, even if you eventually recover without treatment, up to 20% of people will have permanent disability. These people won't be able to use their limb the way they used it before.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1 out of 5 people. To stay at home, that's just asinine. You're gambling. Just go to the hospital. You know, you may need antivenom, you may not. Most envenomations should be treated with antivenom. Some people decline for various reasons, but most of them should be at least offered antivenom, and people do better when they're treated with antivenom. It's as simple as that. People who advocate staying at home and waiting out, that's just dumb.
Yep. Let's move on to the cottonmouth. You know, these are snakes that can get pretty big. And a lot of them, especially along river bottom corridors and things like that throughout the American South, even up into some of the Midwest there. Is there a difference between a bad envenomation for a cotton mouth and one for a copperhead? What's the difference between their venom?
So the venoms are very similar. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the reasons cottonmouth venom is used in the production of Crofab is because it has the same, what we call phospholipase A2 isoforms that copperheads have, so we can make antibodies to those venom components. To answer your question about what's the difference between a bad cottonmouth bite and a bad copperhead bite, mm-hmm. there is no difference. That's the whole point. Severity is independent of the species. So a mild copperhead bite is going to look like a mild cottonmouth bite. A severe copperhead is going to look like a severe cottonmouth. Mm-hmm. Clinically, they're very similar. Now, on average, you might get a little more severity with a cottonmouth, mm-hmm. but there's such great overlap that, you know, making a big distinction between the two is counterproductive. Copperhead bites can be bad. Cottonmouth bites can be mild. You know, you look at the patient. You look at the kind of signs and symptoms he or she is exhibiting. You look at the lab evidence. You look at the systemic. You don't care about the species as much.
When we come back on More Outdoors, we'll talk more with Dr. Spencer Green.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Fluffy bread, classic burger buns, and so many carbs. Carb fear is real. But Hero Bread makes healthier versions of the carb-heavy favorites we love most. We're talking fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, zero sugar, and seriously, great taste. Plus, more of the dietary fiber and protein you want with no compromise. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout.
Welcome back to More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. This is Chester Moore. Don't forget you can get to my blog at higher calling.net and subscribe. Get weekly updates on wildlife, hunting, fishing, conservation, all kind of cool stuff there. We're continuing our fascinating conversation about snake venom and snake bites with Dr. Spencer Green.
So you don't base treatment on what you think is responsible for the bite, but rather what's happening with the patient. And the irony is, a lot of people misidentify the two anyway. They confuse
sure,
the two.
Sure.
Multiple studies have shown that people are not good at identifying snakes.
Yeah, that I get pictures of them sent to me all the time to identify, often hacked in pieces. Hey, can you see what the snake is? Yeah, it was a rat snake. But, you know, that kind of thing. But so you have these two snakes that are very, very common in different areas and a lot of overlap, things like that. And one of the things that you hear all the time is that it's worse to be bitten by a tiny snake, a baby that's just been born, because it can't control its venom flow versus a mature snake. I'm just going to let you have the floor on that one.
Okay. So that's completely untrue, of course. And it's two misconceptions in one. First, babies are born with the ability to regulate their venom delivery just as well as adults can. Mm-hmm. This has been proven before. No question about it. Babies control how much venom they deliver just as well as adults can. Mm-hmm. But even if that myth were true, let's do some simple math. Let's say they delivered all of their venom and they have, say, 4 milligrams worth of venom. Compare that to an adult. Let's say an adult only delivered 25% of its 40 milligrams of venom. Well, 25% of 40 milligrams is still 10 milligrams. Mm-hmm. On average, the larger the snake, the more dangerous. Mm-hmm. Not the baby. I don't know where this myth came from, but it needs to be put to bed. It needs to be put to rest. It's not true. On average, a bite from an adult is way worse than a bite from a juvenile. Mm-hmm. No question about it. Now, that said, there's overlap.
Sure.
A mild bite from an adult is, by definition, less serious than a severe bite from a baby. But on average, the larger snakes are more dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, just the ability to have more venom in them to start off with.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me, but you hear that constantly about, you know, snakes and those kind of things. But probably the one that strikes the most fear in the hearts of people, especially the further west you go, would be the rattlesnake. And of course, Texas, my home state, your home state here, has got many varieties of rattlesnakes, from the aforementioned timber rattler to the pygmy rattler to Of course, the most common, the Western Diamondback. We've even got Mojave Rattlers out west. Let's talk about rattlesnakes for a moment in this category and what you've observed with rattlesnake bites and just rattlesnakes in general.
Yeah, so I love rattlesnakes. I did my fellowship in Arizona, and I worked in Arizona for a few years before moving to Houston. So the first part of my career was all rattlesnakes, and I love rattlesnakes. I'll tell you that, on average, their bites are worse than a copperhead or cottonmouth, no question about it. The same thing I said before applies. A mild rattlesnake bite is still less serious than a severe copperhead or cottonmouth, but more of the rattlesnake bites tend to be moderate and severe. We see more of the hematologic toxicity. We see more of the systemic toxicity. And when it comes to certain species such as Mojave, sometimes we see the neurological toxicity that we don't typically associate with a pit viper bite. Yeah. It's not common, and it's not as severe as a lot of people have been led to believe. I just did a presentation on Mojave rattlesnake venomations down at Venom Week in Scottsdale a few months ago. So I'm kind of fascinated that I'm working on that project right now. But, yeah, rattlesnakes are neat because there's a lot of diversity, and they tend to be large snakes, and they deliver a lot of venom when they bite. So it's exciting.
So on that part, is the rattlesnake envenomation maybe being on average a little worse because of the ability to deliver more venom, or is the venom itself in most rattlesnakes more dangerous?
Both. Okay. So they deliver more venom, and they have different ratios of certain venom components, including the serine proteases and the snake venom metalloproteases, the small basic peptides, a bunch of things that are found in either not at all or in less quantities in other species.
Yeah, and you know, Western Diamondbacks, of course, will congregate in large numbers in certain areas, and people have a lot of overlap with them, whereas something like the Mojave, at least in Texas, and they live in a more remote, typical areas. I was actually out in Alpine. A guy had caught one at a place I was at the day before, and it's a shame because I wanted to see it and photograph it. Really interesting stuff. But let's talk about like that timber rattlesnake for a second. You're saying that has contributed to more deaths in the last couple of decades?
No question about it. I think in our study of the 101 deaths, about half of them we couldn't identify the species. So say for about 50, the timber rattlesnake was responsible for 22 of them.
Wow.
And the two reasons for that is they have a large geographic distribution, so there are a lot of timber rattlesnakes, right? But also, they are the snake of choice in the religious handlers who, the religious leaders who handle snakes. For example, we did analysis state by state, and all the deaths in Kentucky were due to timber rattlesnakes in the setting of religious services.
Yeah. So if you took that part out of it, if you just took that was out of it, and you when you put it out to like encounters in the wild, for example, do you have any idea where it would stand?
It would still be the leading one, but the margin wouldn't be as big. As I said, I think we reported 5 copperhead deaths, 5 eastern diamondbacks. If you get rid of all the religious services, we're still looking at like low teens.
Wow.
So it would outnumber the others. And again, it's because it's a rattlesnake, so on average, worse than the copperhead.
Yeah.
And it's got a huge geographic distribution. I know that we've had 3 snake bite fatalities this year in the United States, and one of them was a timber rattlesnake.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful, beautiful snake. It has also called a canebrake. A lot of people are listening may hear the term canebrake rattlesnake. I think they may. I don't know. I'm not a taxonomist. They divide and change names of snakes all the time. But that's a really cool looking snake that's actually came back in fairly decent numbers in East Texas. No longer considered a threatened species here. But you got stuff like the pygmy rattlesnake. I mean, little tiny guy, and that one's pretty well distributed as well. I mean, they got them from Florida to Texas.
Yep, and then some. Yeah, I just got called about one in Missouri a few days ago.
Wow. And I've only seen one of those in my life, and it was in Newton County, Texas, about 20 years ago on a bow hunt. And then you got things like the Mojave. And now in terms of like, let's talk about the Mojave a second. I mean, this is a fascinating one to me as well because of all the talk about different kinds of interactions. But is there much of their range where they have a very good chance of encountering someone to bite?
I mean, they have a pretty good range. We have them in West Texas all the way west to California.
Yeah.
And what's neat about the Mojave is some of them have what we call the Mojave toxin, which is likely to cause neurotoxicity, and some don't. And they cause a bite more reminiscent of, say, a Western Diamondback. And on occasion, the neurological toxicity can be really impressive. Obviously, it's not unique to Mojaves because we see it with southern Pacific sometimes. We see it occasionally with tiger rattlesnakes and less commonly with snakes that were the result of crossbreeding, such as prairie and western diamondback. But we see some neurological toxicity with those that have the Mojave A toxin. We can also see impressive what we call rhabdomyolysis or muscle breakdown, even in the absence of significant tissue injury. And we see that in the population that have the myotoxin that was recently described in the literature. They're fascinating because sometimes the bites are not that impressive when you look at the arm or leg, but then you see these people and they can't lift their eyes, they can't shrug their shoulders, they can't lift their arms up and require anything. The cool thing is it responds really well to antivenom. Sometimes like they're getting better as the antivenom is being infused, and that's really, really rewarding.
Wow. My question would be, if a average emergency center or doctor can't treat a copperhead bite or a western diamondback bite, and most people going out in the desert probably wouldn't be able to identify a Mojave, I mean, how do they get the right treatment?
The good news is there are a lot of mistakes that doctors make, no question about it.
Yeah.
But the most common one is just failing to pull the trigger on antivenom.
Yeah.
The good news is most doctors are going to be more aggressive when it comes to treating rattlesnakes. So maybe the victim can't identify a Mojave or distinguish it from a western diamondback. If they come in and they're having symptoms and they got bit by a rattlesnake, they'll probably get treated if the facility has the antivenom. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the doctors can end up doing the right thing without knowing much about bites just because they know enough to know, hey, I need to treat this. But you're right. I mean, I do a lot of expert work, and I was involved in a case where a western diamondback envenomation was not treated with antivenom, and it turned out to be a really bad envenomation. The guy spent over a week in the intensive care unit.
Wow.
And that doctor and the hospital were successfully sued. It was, a big deal. That's why, if you're going herping or if you handle snakes, the best thing to do beforehand is to identify the local facility that's most capable of handling a bite.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that.
When we come back on More Outdoors, we'll continue our conversation. Welcome back to More Outdoors on News Talk 560 KLVI. This is Chester Moore. We're wrapping up our conversation about snake bites and snake venom with Dr. Spencer Green. Yeah, that's pretty intense. Now, just because you know a lot about rattlesnakes, and I think they're fascinating, what about the Pacific rattlesnake? What about those snakes over there on the West Coast that we don't think of a whole lot about here in the Central and Southern United States? I mean, I've heard that some of those areas have a fair amount of bites with hikers and things like that.
Absolutely. So we have the Southern Pacific and the Northern Pacific, and I've never treated any of those directly because I've never practiced in California, but I've been called about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, the Southern Pacific is really interesting. Sometimes we get, abnormal labs and sometimes actual clinical bleeding that just doesn't respond well to any antivenom.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine is doing a study right now looking at the newer antivenom, Anavit, and how he has not been able to get control of the hematologic effects, the bleeding effects with Anavit. And we know that with Clotrimazole, sometimes we couldn't get control either. And in addition to the bleeding abnormalities, you can also get the same types of neurological signs and symptoms that we often attribute to Mojave rattlesnakes.
Mm-hmm.
I have more familiarity with the Southern Pacific than the Northern Pacific, although recently a friend of mine was bitten by a Northern Pacific while hiking in California. It was unfortunate. It was his first day of vacation, and he spent the entire vacation in the hospital. But they can be nasty as well. I just don't know as much about them. I think of them as similar to other rattlesnake bites.
I'll tell you what's fascinating to me, just having encountered tons of snakes over the years in many parts of the country, is it's almost like I can take the same species in a different region, and they're just anecdotally seem to be more aggressive. I have certain areas I go in where the cotton mouse are a whole lot more likely to want to strike or bow up on you, and some will just crawl right past you. And other areas where they just, like I said, just sit around. Don't even, I've been photographing them before and I've gotten my, camera lens up pretty close and they slithered up to it and didn't bother it. Other ones, as soon as you manipulate or move them to get a photo, they start going crazy. So I guess a lot of what a bite, you mentioned someone immediately backing up and getting away from the snake. I guess a lot of how many strikes they may get or the chances of being bitten can also depend on what exact individual snake, because snakes are individuals as well.
Snakes are definitely individuals, but I do want to mention that in general, they're not aggressive, they're defensive, and you know this, and I'm sure many of the people listening to this know this.
Uh-huh.
A lot of bad intent is attributed to snakes when they're not trying to go after you. They're just trying to escape. They're trying to, you know, be safe. They'd rather not interact with you at all.
Sure.
But, you know, a lot of the behaviors that are interpreted as being chased are them just trying to get away from the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating. And there's interesting because I've actually, you know, I've done a lot of snake photography in the wild over the years. And with the cottonmouth in particular, I have had more aggressive action trying to photograph diamondback water snakes and yellow belly water snakes than any cottonmouth I've ever messed with. So I think, I've actually had them come at me, like literally, like I take my snake stick and move them. They come right at you. But I've only had one cottonmouth ever come at me when I'm trying to photograph them. Usually they just hold their ground. If you get too close, they strike out and that thing. So that's just interesting of people being able to identify snakes and telling a story. Hey, a cottonmouth chased us in the boat, climbed up the boat and ran us out the boat. That's probably a diamondback water snake or something.
Absolutely. I tell people, it's the water snakes that the little jerks that come after you.
For sure.
And not the water moccasins. Maybe because the water moccasins, I don't know, they have better self-esteem or self-confidence. One, they don't feel they need to show off. It's the water snakes that have these, you know, inferiority complexes, so they have to act tough.
Yeah.
But now, I want to mention one thing. I don't know if this is going to come up or not, so I'm just going to mention it now. I want to talk about how bites occur, because this, too, is a really common myth.
Yeah.
People are under the impression that bites happen when people mess with snakes. But, and several studies have looked at this. I think the study with which I was involved is the best one because the data were collected at the bedside by toxicologists who specialize in treating snake bites. I trust this data more than I trust other data. So we used this data from the North American Snake Bite Registry. We found, and this is across 18 or so sites in the country, so it's copperheads, cottonmouths, rattlesnakes, also coral snakes. The overwhelming majority of bites were not the result of intentionally interacting with the snake, but were people who were unlucky, who didn't see the snake when they stepped on the snake or near the snake or they put their hand in the snake. Yep. Only 19% of the bites were the result of intentional interaction. And I think that's important to understand because I'll talk to a lot of my herpetology friends, the ones who don't know much about medicine, and say, oh, well, all the bites happen when people are messing with snakes. And that might be true in their little, you know, group of friends because they're messing with snakes.
Yeah.
You know, just like if you ask a hockey player what's the most common cause of losing teeth, they'll say, a fight or a puck in the face.
Yeah.
Well, nationally, that's how most people lose their teeth. That's how hockey players lose their teeth. Most bites among herpetologists might result from intentionally interacting because that's what herpetologists do. Mm-hmm. Most bites overall are people who don't see the snake before they get bitten. They're walking around in the dark and they step on the snake, or they're walking in the dark and they step near the snake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had 6 bites this past week, and 5 of them were the result of unintentional interaction. The other one was working on a captive snake and got bitten. But the other 5, they were just walking in the dark, or they reached in somewhere, you know, they were scooping up debris and they got tagged. They didn't see the snake beforehand. They weren't trying to mess with the snake.
Mm-hmm. Well, as someone who messes with snakes, it makes me feel a little better. But, you know, one part of the thing is I think a lot of us who, you know, maybe do photography or something like that, or tend to be maybe at some point more aware and cautious, and you just keep running into the woods and people not thinking about it. Like, a guy I know got bit walking through the marsh with flip-flops on. So, you know, not exactly. And just wasn't paying attention where he's walking. So that's very, very interesting. Is there any breakdown in that study on species like most bitten digging for debris? Or, you know, I've heard several people bitten by copperheads on the hands doing lawn work, you know, digging around leaf beds, stuff like that.
I don't remember if in that study we distinguish it by species.
Yeah.
For my patients, I keep those logs, and last year, something like 82%, I think, maybe 84%, were copperheads that people didn't see before they stepped on near. And you mentioned flip-flops. Flip-flops, definitely the footwear of snake bite victims. You know, if people could just wear sneakers or boots outside when they're walking at night in snake country, we would see fewer snake envenomations.
No
question about it. It's the flip-flops. My most recent bite, I treated him this morning, was a kid who was outside wearing flip-flops.
Very, very interesting. Great stuff. And if someone wants to learn more about what you're doing in your work, is there a place online they can go?
So there's a bunch of great resources. On my website, there's a little section for frequently asked questions.
Yep.
One resource I cannot say enough great things about is the Facebook group National Snake Bite Support, where my colleagues and I, including veterinarians, we answer questions all day about snake bite prevention, snake bite management. We are a resource to healthcare professionals, and we are a resource to snake bite patients and their families. Mm-hmm. So we have a million files in our file section, evidence-based medicine. We answer questions all day about every aspect, pre-hospital care, in-hospital care, post-discharge care. That's a great resource. There's also some great papers that are available, open access online. What I would consider the Bible for managing pit viper envenomations is called the Unified Treatment Algorithm, and it's written by my colleague, Eric Lavonis. I also recommend the American Academy of Emergency Medicine snake bite guidelines. It's a much shorter version of the Unified Treatment Algorithm, updated to account for copperheads now that we know that copperhead bites do better when treated with antivenom, because when the algorithm came out, it was before we did the randomized clinical trial. Mm-hmm. So if they go to AAEM.org and go to like educational material and guidelines, they can find the snake bite management guideline. I really like it. I think it's a great, succinct discussion of what to do. I really like it also because I wrote it.
There you go.
And then finally, there's a really good reference, not only for local bites, but for bites around the world. Mm-hmm. It's the Joint Special Operations Medicine Snake Management Guideline. And it's over 50 pages long. It addresses various snake envenomations in all the different continents. And I'm one of the contributing authors to that as well. So I think it's a great resource.
You know, that's interesting that there's like a global thing to look at, because people in the military, global travel, hunters, fishermen, hikers, backpackers, all around the world. I mean, encountering something in Australia is a lot different than encountering something here in Southeast Texas.
100%.
And we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for listening to the program. You can check me out at higher calling.net, at the Chester Moore on Instagram, Higher Calling Wildlife on Facebook. And of course, every Friday here from 6 to 7 p.m. I'm virtually omnipresent in the outdoors media, Texas Fishing Game Magazine, all over the place in freelance work. And I appreciate every one of you listening to my work. God bless you and have a great outdoors weekend.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.